Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and today we're going to focus on recent papers in lymphomas with Dr. Andrew Zelenitz from the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York. And Andy's put together a series of slides focusing on recent papers in lymphoma. Andy, for each one of these, I just want to start out before we get into some of the ASH papers and other things that have happened in the last few months, and get a little bit of a background of where we are in general with these various lymphomas, beginning with follicular lymphoma. Can you kind of like put in context kind of what's happened, particularly over the last, let's say, 10 years, you know, for people kind of newer to oncology in terms of particularly the evolution of first-line therapy and now a variety of options we have looking at this entity?
So, you know, I'll take a career view. When I started in this, the median survival, the expected median survival of patients with follicular lymphoma was 6 to 8 years, largely because we had limited treatments and we tended to use the treatments over and over again. So, you can't expect an alkylator to work the same way on multiple occasions. Today, at Memorial, in a recent analysis, our median overall survival was 22 years. And in an important paper from the Mayo Clinic by Matt Maurer, you know, a number of years ago, he showed that essentially we're at functional cure of follicular lymphoma. When you compare the long-term outcome of patients in the general population to patients with follicular lymphoma today, most patients are going to live their expected life expectancy. Now, is that true for everyone? No, there are going to be people who die of follicular lymphoma or transformation, which is the most common cause of death in follicular lymphoma, So there have been dramatic improvements. Obviously, the single biggest improvement is rituximab, It is a drug that we can use over and over in different contexts and still expect to see activity. But more recently, and that sort of established chemoimmunotherapy as our first line treatment. Chemoimmunotherapy with rituximab maintenance, we're talking about median progression free survival in the range of eight or 9 years. For first line treatment for median, that's amazingly good. But as we've relapsed, we don't have to keep going back to the same thing. We don't have to give CVP over and over and over again. You know, we have lenalidomide, an active drug. We have bispecific antibodies, which we'll talk a little bit more about. We have CAR T cells, as the data emerges, it might become clearer how do we use these. Because honestly, when CAR T cells were first approved in follicular lymphoma, I wasn't entirely sure where to fit them into the paradigm because we didn't have long enough follow-up to know was the quote-unquote cost worth the benefit. We have other small molecules. We'll talk about some surprising results with activity of a BTK inhibitor when combined with obinutuzumab, showing, pretty substantial activity improvement in a randomized study, which actually has recently led to FDA approval. There are the two things that have really driven improvement in long-term outcome of patients with follicular lymphoma is first of all, rituximab, but then the availability of alternative treatments, not having to go back to the same core treatments with chemoimmunotherapy.
Before we kind of get into some of the newer developments in terms of specific anti-tumor therapy, again, just to kind of put things in context, anything you want to say about the supportive care of these patients, vaccinations, infections, et cetera?
Well, certainly supportive care has made a big difference. Sometimes it's as simple as things like introduction of, you know, effective antiemetics, allowing us to administer these drugs, you know, these chemoimmunotherapy regimens, are, you know, exceedingly well tolerated today. When I was a fellow, they weren't as well tolerated because we had less effective anti-nausea drugs. You know, neutropenia is sort of an annoying thing now. Okay, it used to be a big deal. Febrile neutropenia was a life-threatening event. It still is a life-threatening event, but it's less common because we have growth factor support. We can minimize those effects. So there's no question that in parallel with our improvements in therapeutics, the supportive care improvements have really made outcomes better for patients. And, you know, we've been able to get people through complications that may have in the past been fatal complications.
All right. Well, let's talk about some of the new papers that have come out this year. And I got to say this, really surprised me. I mean, I know there's been attempts. I've seen a diffuse large B cell, et cetera, BTK and non-Hodgkin lymphoma. But this sort of popped up all of a sudden. I'm like, whoa. Can you talk about what they saw there and particularly what it means biologically?
Yeah, so this is the longer term follow-up, and actually this is actually definitive publication of the what we call the Rosewood study, which was a comparison of obinutuzumab versus zanubrutinib plus obinutuzumab. Now, many people gripe about this, the control arm. Oh, but obinutuzumab isn't a standard treatment. Well, I'm sorry. We use rituximab routinely as a single agent with very good efficacy. And obinutuzumab in a randomized style in follicular lymphoma has actually been shown to be the better anti-CD20 compared to rituximab in first-line therapy. So we know that obinutuzumab is an active drug. So I think it's a little disingenuous to say that the control arm here doesn't make any sense. It does make sense. It is active. But we had done this before, right? We gave single agent ibrutinib without very good results. First, there was the study from Nancy Bartlett, then there was the company sponsored study. Low response rates, you know, relatively limited progression-free survival. And even zanubrutinib as monotherapy has had somewhat limited benefit. But interestingly, in this study, it was combined with obinutuzumab. And, the data that sort of speaks for itself. I mean, you know, looking at the progression-free survival in panel B, there is a substantial difference, highly statistically significant. Even in panel A, in the response duration, the curves separate, suggesting that the combination is superior. Overall survival is very similar, but overall survival has become a very challenging endpoint in follicular lymphoma because of the availability of additional treatments. Subsequent treatment really can impact the overall survival of patients. If you look at the forest plot, most of the subgroups we worry about, older patients, bulkier patients, everything favored the combination of zanubrutinib and obinutuzumab. It was well tolerated. No unusual side effects from the combination of obinutuzumab and zanubrutinib, what you would expect for each agent alone. In fact, interestingly, because zanubrutinib has been described as having some neutropenia, obinutuzumab does have some neutropenia, but the combination did not result in excessive neutropenia compared to the monotherapy. there was a little bit more neutropenia, but no increased risk of febrile neutropenia. So, yes, this was a bit of a surprise, and it got FDA approval. So this is now an option that we have for patients in the relapse refractory setting.
So usually when we see a new data set, the two questions we have is, what do you think it means in terms of taking patients right now? And what do you think it means in terms of like trial designs for new trials? But here, like, I really have those two questions. So can you envision yourself using any BTK inhibitor in follicular lymphoma, and how and when?
Yeah, so in data that actually I probably should have put in, but I didn't actually, there's only so much stuff I could put in a presentation. There's also some pirtobrutinib data in relapse refractory follicular lymphoma. Now, again, it's single agent, but the response rates were reasonable. Progression-free survival was shorter than we're seeing here with the combination. But there was clearly activity. So the problem that we had was that ibrutinib just probably wasn't the best agent for follicular lymphoma for whatever reason. It does have it inhibits ADCC. So when you combine an antibody with ibrutinib, you never see a benefit, right? We have that in CLL. We've seen it in follicular lymphoma. But zanubrutinib and acalabrutinib don't have that problem. They do not inhibit ADCC. And so you can definitely get combinatorial effects. I think this is a very reasonable option that can be used, in patients. Now, every patient with follicular lymphoma is, you have to treat them individually. So say someone has, gets R-CHOP, they have a 5.5-6 year remission, they get rituximab lenalidomide, a second line, and they have another 3 or 4 year remission. Are you going to take that patient to CAR T cell next? Probably not. Could you take them to a bispecific? Sure, that's an option, but so would be obinutuzumab zanubrutinib. That, would be a reasonable option, with, minimal toxicity. So, it fits in the paradigm of, patients with, multiply relapsed disease. We need to figure out, does it work post CAR T? Does it work post, bispecific? Because once we have those data, then we have a better sense of where to put it in the sequence.
Incidentally, any thoughts about BTK and diffuse large B cell? I know it's been looked at. It seemed like it sort of failed, but maybe some subset. Any future?
Well,
there?
It failed, the curves are R-CHOP plus ibrutinib versus R-CHOP. The curves are literally identical. But interestingly, if you separate out younger and older patients, there's a clear benefit, not only just a benefit, but a survival benefit for patients under the age of 60. So the question in that trial was that the consequence of biology, or is it the consequence of toxicity? But now we have molecular analysis from that trial. And interestingly, actually older patients have the more sensitive subtypes. The MCD is one of the most sensitive subtypes for ibrutinib plus R-CHOP, but they had far more toxicity. They just simply didn't tolerate the treatment. So this has been resurrected. There's the Escalade trial looking at acalabrutinib plus R-CHOP versus R-CHOP. We'll see if a better tolerated BTK inhibitor changes the result of that Phoenix trial.
Should be really interesting. Let's talk a little bit about CAR T and this paper from Ash looking at the phase 3 ALARA trial.
So So this is important. You know, the Ilara trial, when initially presented by Dr. Catherine Tibblemont, you know, clearly showed an advantage. You know, excellent results, high complete response rates. But the follow-up was very short. And if you're going to sort of invest, you know, have the patient invest into a CAR T, you really want to see some durable benefit. It was just too early when the data was first presented. But here we see further follow-up. Now the median follow-up is 41 months, ranging from just under 3 years, 34 months, to over 4 years, 49 months. The complete response rate didn't change. It would have been a little surprising if it did, but it's 68%. It is important to achieve a complete response. Complete responders have a far better outcome. I didn't have an opportunity to show those curves here, but they do. That was previously shown and as actually has been published already. One of the analyses here looked at those patients who had experienced progression within 24 months versus those who hadn't. And yes, if you progress within 24 months, there is a impact on progression-free survival. Patients who are being treated with CAR T cells who have not progressed within 24 months clearly are doing, you know, a little bit better. But it's interesting, you know, as I said, this is follicular lymphoma. We want to see the long-term result. And it's actually interesting to me, though, you know, again, we need a little bit more follow-up. The tails of those POD24 curves are coming together, suggesting that there's this group of patients who might, just might, have a very durable benefit. You know, are they cured? Well, it's probably still a little bit early. But if we look at the overall survival, that is not impacted whether you're POD24 or not. And that is different than what we had seen in the past. It looks like CAR T cell can potentially be changing the natural history of relapse refractory follicular lymphoma. You know, we'll see the updated Zuma 5 results in a moment. And that too, also with, you know, longer term follow-up, you know, is showing these excellent results. And Svatva Neelapul from MD Anderson presented these updated data. This is now 4-year data as compared to the 3-year data. Here, the median progression free survival was 57 months, which is really quite impressive. Interestingly, initially when this study was first presented, there seemed to be a difference between follicular lymphoma patients and marginal zone lymphoma patients. The marginal zone lymphoma patients seem to have completely caught up. And so, the progression-free survival now overlaps between all the patients in the study, which you can barely see. It's that orange curve, the follicular lymphoma patients, the black curve, and, the marginal zone patients, the teal curve. But I want to bring people's attention to the bottom, and that is the cumulative incidence of recurrence. And so that blue, the solid blue curve that's shown there is the cumulative incidence of recurrent follicular lymphoma. Now, it's not 5%. Okay. It's 40%, but it flattens out. And this is giving us a hint that it's maybe this is a potentially curative therapy. You know, we have another curative therapy, allogeneic stem cell transplant. It also has some treatment-related mortality, and, you know, we're seeing some of that here. In the dotted curve, but it's nothing like what we see in allotransplant. This is obviously more available treatment. It's less demanding treatment than an allotransplant. So we're seeing a hint that there might be a curative outcome. Obviously, we'd like to see further follow-up. 4 years is still a little bit short, but it is very intriguing. It's really quite promising. So not to be outdone, of course, we have to look at the data with lisicaptagene marilucel. Lisicaptagene marilucel, like tisagen leclucel from the ELERA trial, is a 4-1BB construct as opposed to the axicaptagene, which is a CD28 co-stimulatory domain. This study particularly asked the question, what happens if you use CAR T cell in second line follicular lymphoma? So after failure from either chemoimmunotherapy, or in some cases, these were failures of rituximab, lenalidomide. And you can see that the overall and complete response rates are outstandingly good. I mean, 96% is about as good as you could ask for. And the probability of progression-free survival and overall survival among the responders shown here. It's really excellent. The follow-up in this study compared to the prior two that we just saw is quite short. Now, it's raising an interesting question. We're seeing activity in second line, but to me, you know, we're seeing second line versus second line is this blue line, the third line and beyond is the gold line. And interestingly, though they separate a little bit, they're not separating super dramatically. So, I think we really need further follow-up to know whether second line is the right place for CAR T cell, or, you know, it would be okay to wait further and use alternative treatment. You know, we're still looking to see long-term outcomes in terms of side effects. You know, it seems that cytopenias tend to resolve. Hypogammaglobulinemia occurs, but tends to slow down after a couple of years. The long-term results look promising, but they have to be balanced by long-term safety. So, obviously, and I mentioned this earlier, that, you know, we don't just have CAR T cell as a new form of immunotherapy. We have bispecific antibodies, and there are actually a number of bispecific antibodies that are being developed. But the furthest along and clinically approved is mosunetuzumab. And Steve Schuster presented these long-term data of patients who had been treated on the original phase 2 mosunetuzumab study. The curve shown here, and you know, let's focus on this duration of response curve in the upper left-hand corner. This panel shows that with the updated data, we're not seeing a lot of late events that are causing the curve to drop. So those estimates that we got from the earlier analysis, are really holding up. So the median duration of response is 3 years. This is really quite meaningful. And, you know, in some small series and anecdotal data, you know, patients can be retreated. It's like rituximab. They can be retreated with an antibody, a bispecific antibody, and have good responses. Obviously, the quality of response makes a huge difference, and this is true with CAR T cells. It's also true with bispecifics. the patients who only have a PR, those patients are going to progress. Those are patients you should, you know, think about, well, if they got a good they got a reasonable response, you might want to then use that as a bridge to that CAR T, because they're not going to have a durable response if they only had a partial remission. But the you know, median progression-free survival, 2 years, overall survival looks really quite excellent. Again, confounded by the fact that there are additional active treatments available for our patients. So, you know, we're in an era of now, that's not the only bispecific. We have epcoritamab that's almost certainly going to be approved this year. We expect that later this year. Subcutaneous formulation, easy to administer, highly effective, results similar to what we're seeing with mosunetuzumab, maybe slightly better, but it's hard, cross-trial comparisons and all. Odronextamab also is coming, on interesting results also in follicular lymphoma. So where do these drugs move? Well, it's hard to move a CAR T too far up, but in follicular lymphoma, I could easily see moving bispecifics to the front line. Obviously, we're already there. There were two trials presented at ASH of mosunetuzumab in first line, mosunetuzumab plus lenalidomide from Europe, and mosunetuzumab monotherapy led by Lorenzo Falchi at Memorial, but in a multi-center trial, showing high response rates. They're a little bit of a warning signal that maybe there are some patients who are emerging who are CD20 negative, and maybe monotherapy isn't the way to go. Maybe you want to hit the tumor in multiple ways to suppress the emergence of CD20 negative variants.
So just a couple of final questions about FL. First of all, in terms of sequencing, what comes first, bispecifics or CAR T, and do you sort of tailor that to the patient's situation? And also, which CAR T theoretically do you think is preferable?
There's no clear-cut answer here. It's an excellent question. The sequencing question is always important, but it really depends on what's happening. Now, I have to say one thing that when with the longer term follow-up, particularly of Zuma 5 with the 4-year follow-up and seeing this plateauing of recurrence of follicular lymphoma, that the event rate is becoming very low. It makes you think maybe this is truly a one and done. And that means you would move it up a little bit more. Honestly, I would like to see a little bit for more follow-up, but typically I'm using Mosin right now, which is the commercially approved, outside of a trial, before CAR T-cell, but there are certain examples. I mean, I had a 52-year-old woman, had R-CHOP, had a 6-month benefit, biopsy, she was still follicular lymphoma. This patient was not going to do well. We gave her bridging therapy, got her into a reasonable remission, and gave her axicabtagene silolucel, and thus far is doing well. So in individual circumstances, you're going to say, gee, the handwriting's on the wall. We already know this patient's going to do poorly. Let's maybe go with a treatment that potentially is one and done.
In terms of which CAR T, assuming you had the availability of all three, any one in particular you would prefer in an elderly patient in a borderline performance status?
So with elderly patients in borderline performance status, both Tisagen Leclucel and Lisocabtagene Maralucel have, are just safer drugs. They have lower CRS risk. In absolute numbers, they also have lower high-grade CRS risk. In the younger patient, well, you know, the results, you know, as I showed you for lisocabtagene maraleucel look good. But again, we only have 24 months of follow-up. In a younger patient, we are having now with this long-term follow-up from Zuma 5, I feel more comfortable offering axicabtagene to a younger patient who's going to tolerate it well, simply because, you know, we have this longer-term follow-up. We really know what's happening.
So let's move on to what is becoming one of my favorite topics in oncology, mantle cell lymphoma. I know it's not that common, but it's very interesting.
Yeah, so, you know, I'm old enough that, you know, mantle cell lymphoma didn't exist when I started. There was only one person who could make the diagnosis, and that was Carl Leonard. And he did it morphologically, and he saw these cells that were arising in the mantle zone. And, you know, he called these mantle zone lymphomas. And it was like, hey, you know, all the people can't make this diagnosis. And finally, in the right around 93, 94, the hallmark genetic abnormality of mantle cell lymphoma was identified, and that is the translocation of cyclin D1 to the immunoglobulin heavy chain locus. And now all of a sudden we have reagents where we could routinely identify. And one of the things we immediately did is look back at all the old cases and say, where were these hiding and how did they do? And we got the unfortunate finding that they were hiding and they didn't do very well. Median survivals of classic mantle cell lymphoma were 3 to 5 years. Blastic forms were 1 to 3 years. And we had not yet really appreciated that there was this low grade or more indolent form of mantle cell lymphoma. But let's, you know, fast forward 20 years, we now understand that mantle cell lymphoma biologically is actually quite complex. Like CLL, it has two different cells of origin. The mantle cell lymphoma arising from IGHV mutated cells that have passed through the germinal center tend to have the more indolent course. And those patients actually are most frequently observed with low tumor burden. They can be observed for a number of years. We have the classic mantle cell lymphoma, proliferations usually less than 30%, mostly, you know, diffuse, intermediate size cells. That's the group of patients who traditionally we took to upfront transplant with actually reasonably good results, though this has now been supplanted in many of our minds by the triangle study, which we can talk a little bit about. And then we recognized that there were pleomorphic and blastic forms. These were frequently associated with TP53 mutation. And one of the things we've identified is that mutation of P53 is associated with very poor outcomes. Transplant does not overcome the adverse impact of P53 mutation. When we look at the Nordic data, the patients who got upfront transplant, if they had a P53 mutation, their curves just go straight down. There are no long-term survivors, despite getting the very aggressive chemoimmunotherapy with high-dose therapy and stem cell rescue. So we've learned a lot about this disease. As a result, our outcomes have improved dramatically with the introduction of new agents a more thoughtful approach about how to take care of patients with different subtypes of mantle cell lymphoma. So this is the Simpatico study. And, you know, sort of the introduction here, of course, is, you know, one of the new agents that has clearly been shown to have activity in mantle cell lymphoma are Bruton tyrosine kinase inhibitors. Initially approved was ibrutinib, but subsequently both acalabrutinib and zanubrutinib have been approved for the treatment of relapsed refractory mantle cell lymphoma. And actually most recently, pirtobrutinib is also approved for relapsed refractory mantle cell lymphoma, you know, having been exposed to prior BTK inhibitor. Also, some of the early work in the development of venetoclax, the BH3 mimetic, the BCL2 inhibitor, suggested that there were responses in patients with mantle cell lymphoma. So there was, you know, initially a lot of excitement about venetoclax, but it turns out that as a single agent, just by itself, venetoclax, though was active, it tended to have a relatively limited duration of benefit in patients with mantle cell lymphoma. But it led to the hypothesis, well, if there's some activity of venetoclax and ibrutinib works, what about adding venetoclax to the backbone of a BTK inhibitor? So this study was conceived, and this was a blinded placebo-controlled trial of ibrutinib plus placebo versus ibrutinib plus venetoclax. And this is the primary endpoint, which was the investigator-assessed progression-free survival. There was a substantial improvement, highly statistically significant, with a hazard ratio of 0.65 in favor of the combination of ibrutinib plus venetoclax. Now, unfortunately, ibrutinib has been withdrawn from the U.S. Market. It's still listed in the NCCN guidelines, so you can get it. I know some people have substituted other BTK inhibitors in this regimen to use acalabrutinib or venetoclax plus ibrutinib. Obviously, there's a lot of interest in the incorporation of BTK inhibitors in mantle cell lymphoma, but people are often afraid of fixing what's not broken. You know, so we know that chemoimmunotherapy followed by transplant is quite good, but how do you then test something new? And so one approach to testing something new is to do what's called a window study. So you do a couple of cycles of another treatment before you give the standard treatment, and you can sort of assess how you did, and then you can proceed with the standard treatment. So at least you get some idea, you get a quote unquote window into how it's working. This was a window study that included rituximab and acalabrutinib administered for two cycles before standard RDHACs, according to the Lima protocol. Acalabrutinib was then reintroduced at the end during the first year. There's 3 years of rituximab maintenance. During the first year of maintenance, acalabrutinib was reintroduced. And what we can see is just if you look just past two cycles of rituximab plus acalabrutinib, already there's a substantial complete response rate of 57%. Obviously, when you complete the chemoimmunotherapy, it increases further. Post high dose therapy and stem cell rescue, the complete response rate was 93%. You can see the progression-free and overall survival curves. They're quite promising. This is a small study. Obviously, if one wanted to build on this, one would need to compare to a standard of care. I think probably the current standard of care would be a triangle-like approach where you use the chemoimmunotherapy with a BTK inhibitor in induction. Then you give the high-dose therapy and stem cell rescue, and then you follow that with the maintenance BTK inhibitor and rituximab maintenance. Is the transplant really necessary in the triangle approach? I'm not sure. At Memorial, we have actually opted to drop the transplant because the two arms that included the ibrutinib look very similar, though we need more events to know that they really are indistinguishable. So more data to come on that. But this is an interesting window study and got us to understanding that acalabrutinib and rituximab can be used. We're going to hear more about that in a second. Pirtobrutinib is a different type of BTK inhibitor, unlike acalabrutinib, ibrutinib, and zanubrutinib. It is a non-covalent BTK inhibitor. What we think it's doing is shown in panel in the lower panel, the cartoon. It's the B. What we think is that pirtobrutinib sort of locks BTK into an inactive conformation. And yes, there are resistance mutations that will make BTK insensitive to pirtobrutinib, but because pirtobrutinib does not covalently bind to the cysteine 481 site, we're not dependent on the covalent binding, and we can treat patients who have BTK covalent BTK resistant disease. And here are the duration of response, progression-free, and overall survival. These obviously look quite promising, considering this is a highly refractory relapse population, with a median response duration of about 18 months, a median progression-free survival of 12 to 15 months. Yet another option we have in the relapse refractory setting. How do we fit this in? Where do we fit it? With now that we have CAR T cells. I think the CAR T cell story here, in my opinion, is a little different than what we just saw in follicular lymphoma. And we'll talk about that. But as I said, that window study was very interesting. Dr. Jane at the MD Anderson took it one step further, and they said, well, forget the rest of the chemotherapy. I'm going to test this in patients who I wouldn't give aggressive chemoimmunotherapy to, and I'm just going to give acalabrutinib and rituximab as first-line therapy. So this was continuous acalabrutinib for 24 months, and then rituximab weekly for four doses, then monthly until month 12, and then every other month until month 24. Median age for this study was 69, which is not that old, to be perfectly honest. Most patients had classic morphology. There were a few patients with blastic or pleomorphic morphology. But interestingly, there were in those patients where P53 mutation was sequencing was done, which was in 43 patients. 12 of them had either mutation or deletion. Now, deletion probably by itself without mutation probably does not impact outcome. So we need a little bit more detail. But the initial results here are really remarkably promising. Very short follow-up. Median follow-up is only 17 months. So that means most of these patients are still on active treatment. Very intriguing results with just the acalabrutinib rituximab combination that had been used in that window study. So we know that CAR T cell is approved in mantle cell lymphoma, but you can't use just plain run-of-the-mill axicabtagene. Why? Because axicabtagene, you isolate T cell, you take the bulk leukapheresis product and you transduce it. So if there are circulating tumor cells, you could potentially transduce those cells. So there's a modification to the production of the CAR T cell where there's a selection for T cells first. And so the T cells are selected and then those purified T cells are transduced. It's transduced with the exact same transgene that we use with axicabtagene, but we give the drug a new name. It's brexicabtagene autolucel. And that is simply because we're now using purified T cells to produce the product. Zuma 2 was the original study. It was a phase 2 study to ask whether there was activity. We now have 4 years of follow-up, and the median overall survival is looking quite good. You know, these were mostly patients in third and fourth line treatment, and you know, there's almost a 4 year median overall survival now. This was specifically focused on overall survival, not on progression-free survival. And one of the concerns that we have is, unlike follicular lymphoma, we're starting to see the evidence of a plateau in progression-free survival. With mantle cell lymphoma, we're seeing more of a continuous relapse risk without that plateau. More to come. There was an expanded access study called Zuma 18. It was very small, only 27 patients. Again, this is overall survival, and you can see the overall survival is sort of, drifting down. But the complete response rate was really quite similar to what was seen in the phase 2 study, even though almost none of these patients would have been eligible for the phase 2 study because of comorbidities or issues. So clearly, CAR T cells have activity in relapsed refractory mantle cell lymphoma, but is it one and done? We need more follow-up to know. I'm concerned that there is a continuous relapse risk. So the other drug that we have for relapsed refractory mantle cell lymphoma is lisocabtagene maraleucel. That is already has a purification step where CD4 and CD8 cells are separated. So no change in manufacturing was required to treat patients with mantle cell lymphoma. And this was, you know, coming back to, you know, earlier question about, well, gee, what, how do patients tolerated, you know, is there an improvement in patients' outcome? This was a sub-study focused on patient-reported outcomes. And the numbers are a little bit hard to read, and I apologize for that. In general, what is seen is that there is improvement in a variety of domains of quality of life with treatment with CAR T cells. So despite the fact that the CAR T cell procedure itself, you know, has associated toxicity, there are improvement in multiple domains after the treatment is done. One of the other studies that was presented at ASH, this is actually from Dr. Anita Kumar, this was a study done at Memorial and MGH, specifically for patients who had P53 mutant mantle cell lymphoma. So as I already mentioned, P53 mutant mantle cell lymphoma is a high-risk category. Chemoimmunotherapy clearly is not the right approach for these patients. Adapted this Bovin regimen, which includes obinutuzumab and zanubrutinib lead-in for 2 months. Then venetoclax is ramped up. Obinutuzumab is continued through month 8, and then venetoclax and zanubrutinib go through month 24. If patients achieve undetectable measurable disease, residual disease at 24 months, they stop treatment. If they have less than, if they still have detectable measurable residual disease, they continue on the zanubrutinib and venetoclax. This is really quite impressive. If we compare this to prior chemoimmunotherapy regimens, overall response rate of 96% and a complete metabolic response rate of 88%. Interestingly, you know, sort of looking at the window, just obinutuzumab and zanubrutinib by itself for 2 months resulted in a 68% metabolic complete response. The progression-free and overall survival are shown here. Again, like the Windows study that acalabrutinib rituximab study from Dr. Jain, this is still a little early because the median follow-up is only 24 months, 23 months. So we need further follow-up with patients off treatment. But it did meet its primary endpoint, which is why it was reported, and that was having at least 11 patients progression-free at 2 years. We're actually up to 14 patients progression-free at 2 years. So, you know, we have interesting approaches to first-line poor-risk mantle cell lymphoma. We have the introduction of CAR T cells, and we will see the introduction of bispecifics. Bispecifics have turned out to be a little bit more challenging than other areas because of effectiveness. They're highly effective, but they're a little bit more toxic because of the circulating tumor cells.
So, just one question about this, particularly the issue of whether or not we need to be using chemotherapy at this point as far as first-line therapy of mantle cell, particularly in older patients. And you know, we were doing a webinar last night. We were talking about the recent pan-tumor approval of T-DXd and how prior to that time, all the different tumor things, they were trying to get enough data to show that they could use it. And then the FDA comes along and says, okay, we got enough data, you can use it. We don't need any more trials, or we don't need these type of trials. And I guess my question is, are you comfortable if a patient comes in, you know, they may be, I'm sure you have patients who are medical oncologists who say, you know, can you treat me with that chemotherapy, BTK, anti-CD20, and maybe venetoclax?
So we actually have a separate study that will be presented in a few weeks at EHA of the Bovin regimen. And the Bovin regimen, specifically for quote unquote transplant ineligible mantle cell lymphoma, there is a great interest in chemotherapy free approaches. The acalabrutinib rituximab data look very promising. We have similar data that will be presented at EHA in transplant ineligible patients. Who got the 3-drug Bovin regimen, and those results really look very promising. Obviously they look a little bit better than the exclusive P53 mutant cohort, though there were a bunch of P53 mutant patients in the transplant ineligible group. It is interesting that this is clearly active, we will see clearly the development of additional regimens. We're going to see the introduction of bispecifics early in the treatment of mantle cell lymphoma. But, you know, we do have to be careful about the excess toxicity we see with circulating tumor cells. So, you know, there might need to be some pre-treatment to reduce the circulating tumor burden.
All right, let's talk about diffuse large B cell.
So, you know, diffuse large B cell lymphoma, if we think about the big landscape, we've been looking for a very long time to improve the outcome of patients with diffuse large B cell lymphoma, largely by trying to do what we call R-CHOP plus X. Most of these R-CHOP plus X have actually been negative, and that included ibrutinib. And more recently, bortezomib was negative and it turned positive in a subset, so which is sort of interesting. Lenalidomide was negative. So the alternative is let's try a new drug. So we had the Polarix trial, which was R-CHOP versus R-CHIP polatuzumab. The vincristine was removed, replaced by a antibody drug conjugate of a very potent vinca alkaloid, MMAE, which has to be targeted to the tumor, otherwise there's excessive toxicity. And there was a 7%, 6-7% improvement in progression-free survival, no improvement in overall survival. And it has been approved and it is an appropriate option in the first line treatment. But in that initial analysis in the forest plots, we saw a bit of a surprising result. And that is activated B cell lymphoma seemed to have all of the benefit. The GCB tumors, there was sort of no difference between R-CHOP and R-CHIP POLA, but there was a big difference in the by cell of origin. So this study from Frank Morschhauser tried to look in a little bit more about what happened. And so this the upper panel shows the outcome by cell of origin. You can see that the two arms completely overlap for the GCB tumors, but for the activated B cell tumors, and this was done by gene expression profiling, not by the Hans algorithm, there are very substantial improvement in ABC tumors. Now, interestingly, in the small group of patients who couldn't be classified, there didn't seem to be much of a difference. I mean, there was a trend in favor of R-CHOP, but that was just a trend. In trying to look at this a little bit further, there was an analysis to sort of break out the GCB tumors and see if there were any GCB tumors that may have in fact benefited from R-CHIP polatuzumab. And as you can see from that Sankey plot, there's a small group of GCB tumors that have something we call the dark zone signature. These are quite similar, but not exactly the same as EZB tumors. But these tumors did have a improvement in outcome when treated with R-CHIP polatuzumab. Unfortunately, this is not a signature that's readily available in clinical practice. So, and it's a very small proportion of the population, representing only 12% of the patients. So given that it's such a small proportion of the patients, when I apply Polarix, I'm using it in the ABC tumors, not in the GCBs. We looked, Frank looked further about by looking at lymphgen subtypes, because it's not just ABC versus GCB, but there are actually a variety of different types. And we can see, like the dark zone signature, which would be expected, there was a little bit of benefit in the EZB. They overlap quite a bit. There was improvement in the MCD tumors, which are the largest group of the ABC tumors. Interestingly, some benefit in the unclassifiable tumors by the LymphGen. So this gives us a little bit of insight as to why biologically we're seeing differences in outcome with the R-CHIP Pola regimen. So, you know, as I mentioned, you know, one way to, you know, challenge the paradigm, do we really need R-CHOP? Can we do something different? Is you do a window study. And Jason Weston at MD Anderson has taken this window study idea to an interesting way. He initially did a study that was called Smart Start, but this is Smart Stop, and it uses a completely novel regimen of lenalidomide, tafasitamab, and rituximab combined with acalabrutinib, which he calls Ultra. And four cycles are given, and then patients are assigned to either receive six more cycles of Ultra and two cycles of CHOP if they're in a CR, or six cycles of Ultra and six cycles of CHOP if they're in a partial response or have stable disease. So if you look just at the lead-in result, the CR rate was 63% from just four cycles of the Ultra regimen. Interestingly, it was as high as 80% in the small group of patients with GCB tumors. So this was not active just in ABC, but also in GCB tumors. When looking at the end of treatment response, depending on the you know, group A or group B treatment, the complete response rate was 100%. And we actually haven't seen 100% complete response rates in large cell lymphoma. So this is an interesting result, but small numbers, and obviously needs to be confirmed. If we look at measurable residual disease by a very sensitive assay, has a sensitivity of about one cell in a million. Just post the Ultra for four cycles, about a third of patients actually have undetectable measurable residual disease at the level of 10 to the minus six. And at the end of one cycle of R-CHOP, those numbers don't change very much. We're still waiting for the end of treatment MRD results, which are being worked on. Interestingly, in the next cohort of this study, basically it's going to drop the addition of CHOP. So if you're having a very good response, you'll just get the Ultra rather than Ultra plus two cycles of R-CHOP. So another new drug that was introduced a number of years ago was tafasitamab, when combined with lenalidomide, had some really remarkable results. These are the end of study final results at 5 years. These have now been published in Hematologica. One thing that you can see is that there has been a pretty consistent complete response rate over the course of the data. Median progression-free survival in this relapse refractory setting has been about a year. But this study was pretty seriously criticized for its methodology. Early on, it eliminated patients with refractory disease. Only relapse patients could go on. And then there was a signal that prior lines of therapy had a big impact. And you can see that here, that if you had only one prior line of therapy versus having two or more prior lines of therapy, the outcome was better. I actually personally don't think that's a very valid criticism. Of course, if you're in third or fourth line treatment, you're not going to do as well as in second line treatment. One of the things that was very surprising was the probability of duration of response And if you responded, it didn't matter if you were in first line or in second line or third line or fourth line. It didn't make any difference. And that was so what it tells us is this is an active regimen. It's best in more favorable patients who have relapsed disease rather than refractory disease. The patients who respond can have very durable responses. So interesting final results. A lot of additional studies are ongoing with tafasitamab. Another drug that was introduced several years ago, sort of in the lead up to bispecifics and CAR T cells, was Lonca. This is an antibody drug conjugate that delivers the tesserine moiety. There is some capillary leak syndrome associated with it. There's a bit of a learning curve, though it has been dramatically reduced by the current administration schedule of giving high dose for 2 weeks and then lowering the dose for the subsequent treatment. But Dr. Kamey presented updated data at EHA last year. Still relatively early with a median follow-up of only 8 months. 25% complete response rates. For those patients who responded, the response duration was reasonable at a year. This might have some role as a bridging therapy. It targets CD19, some people are concerned that, I don't want to target CD19 prior to giving a CD19 directed CAR T cell. We're starting to see other CAR T cells emerge, CD22, CD19-22. So this might actually have a role in that bridging area. So one of the things we really want to know is how can we accelerate clinical trials? Having to wait 2 years or 5 years after treating patients with large cell lymphoma is just too long. It's hard to make progress. And we want early predictors. This technology PhaseSeq is a very sensitive methodology that can be used on circulating tumor DNA. This was a parallel study. This was a correlative study to the TRANSFORM study, which compared lisocabtagene marilucel to standard of care high-dose therapy and stem cell rescue for patients receiving second-line treatment. This led to the approval of lisocabtagene marilucel in the second line. This was an important application of this technology, and it was whether it really actually worked. So one of the important things is that a phased variant is a mutation that occurs close enough on the same strand of DNA so that you can pick up the variants in two areas, and it dramatically reduces PCR errors and improves sensitivity. So you get a sensitivity of about one cell in a million if you put enough DNA into the assay. And one of the interesting things is they were able to show that they could identify phase variants in most patients, and using the kinetics of response, they were able to identify patients who were responders and who are likely to do well over the long term. So we need more data with cell-free DNA, this is a promising approach. So another option is In addition to CAR T cells in the relapse refractory setting for large cell lymphoma, we have glofitamab. We have bispecific antibodies. Glofitamab is a bispecific antibody that has two binding sites for CD20 and a single binding site for CD3. This just reported on some of the long-term results in patients. The drug is given. There's an initial dose of obinutuzumab to clear circulating B cells. The glofitamab is given in a stepped-up dosing until you hit the target dose. There's a total of 12 cycles of treatment. 154 patients were treated, and the complete response rate was 40%. But one of the analyses that I found very interesting in this study was that they looked at total tumor metabolic tumor volume and TMTV, and how much disease you had prior to treatment with glofitamab had a big impact. And you can see this simply divided the population to two groups, TMTV above the median versus those below the median. Those who had higher tumor burdens above the median really had far inferior results. This suggests to me this might be better combined with something to help try to reduce some of that bulk so that the glofitamab can be more effective give results more like on the blue part of the curve. Epcoritamab is a second FDA-approved bispecific antibody for large cell lymphoma. This is the EPCOR-1 study with a longer follow-up. What we're seeing is that there is something approaching a plateau in the overall survival curve. Suggesting that some patients are deriving long-term benefit. The median overall survival was 18 months. Obviously, we'd like it to be longer than that, it suggests that combinations, including epcoritamab, can be effective. And finally, to sort of wrap up, I want to just talk a little bit about classical Hodgkin lymphoma. Classical Hodgkin lymphoma has, had some big changes in the last few years. We initially had a, standard of care for, a couple of decades that was ABVD chemotherapy. It was challenged with the Echelon 1 trial that compared ABVD to brentuximab vedotin combined with AVD chemotherapy. BVAVD is not the world's easiest treatment to give, but it became the standard of care when we ultimately saw an overall survival difference emerge in favor of the BVAVD arm. But in parallel with this, we saw the development of checkpoint inhibitors very active in relapsed refractory Hodgkin lymphoma. So the obvious question was, can we move a checkpoint inhibitor to the upfront setting? SWOG recently conducted a study that had to be closed prematurely because of a superiority of the Nevo AVD arm compared to the BVAVD arm. Emerging as a new potential standard of care. BVAVD is particularly tough in older patients. In the original Echelon 1 trial, where we had hoped that, you know, because bleomycin was so toxic to in older patients, we hoped that BVAVD would actually be a good treatment for the older patient. Well, it turned out that that was such a toxic regimen that it was even inferior to ABVD for the older patient. Sarah Rutherford at Cornell undertook this sub-analysis of the SWOG 1826 trial, which compared nivolumab AVD to brentuximab vedotin AVD, but specifically focusing on the older patient population. So one of the things that can be seen is that the adverse event profile was superior for patients who received nivolumab compared to brentuximab. There was the fatigue was similar in both arms. There was a little bit more neutropenia in the Nivo AVD arm. However, they did not receive prophylactic growth factor, whereas every patient received prophylactic growth factor in the BVAVD arm. But in general, you can see that the toxicity was less with Nivo AVD. And because it was better tolerated, what we see is actually a very substantial difference in 1 year progression-free survival of 93% for Nivo AVD versus 64% for BVAVD. This is even substantially more bigger difference than we saw in the overall population. This to me is indicative that this should be the standard of care in the older patients with classical Hodgkin lymphoma. And with that, I'd like to thank you all for your attention.